Well, I wonder if you've ever found yourself in the wrong place at the wrong time. We were talking in Life Group this last week, and our opening question, just to get people talking, was what are some of the things that you do in order to prepare to go away on holiday? And of course, there were all kinds of answers, you know, packing the suitcase and packing the passports and getting the sun cream and all that stuff. But one of the things that was mentioned was it's worthwhile checking departure times before heading to the airport. Not long after Diane and I were married, Diane was asked to be bridesmaid at a wedding of one of her closest childhood friends over in England. And so we made our plans, we bought our tickets, we booked the car, all well in advance. And when the week finally came, I took Diane to the airport. She flew over ahead of me in order to take part in doing whatever bridesmaids do. And I was to follow her a few days later on the Friday in order to be there for the wedding on Saturday. Well, Friday came. I finished up my work. I packed my bags. I headed to the airport that afternoon, arriving around 6 p.m. in plenty of time for the flight at 8 p.m. I got up to the counter. I gave the attendant my ticket details, at which point she looked up at me and said, "You've missed your flight. It went out this morning at 8 a.m. I was mortified. I think that was back in the days before cell phones were just so easily. So I went to the payphone, phoned Diane real quick, and of course, I had to buy a new ticket in order to get over that evening. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And of course, being in the wrong place at the wrong time can have far more serious consequences, and we see an example of that in our passage this morning. And throughout this Lenten season, we have been looking together at people who found themselves in the shadow of the cross that first Good Friday. And so far, we've looked at the self-righteous religious leaders. We've looked at the callous crowd that gathered that day. We looked at the self-serving Roman soldiers and the Roman authorities. We looked together at the dying thieves. Today, we come to the last group of people who found themselves there that day, the compassionate carers and faithful friends. And the first one that we come to in our text this morning is a man called Simon, who becomes a burden bearer. We don't know much about Simon, except that he was from Cyrene. It was a place located on a plateau about 10 miles from the Mediterranean Sea in what is now Libya, west of Egypt. Mark tells us that Simon was the father of Alexander and Rufus, and that he was passing by on his way in from the country. We don't know much else about Simon, except that he was probably a Jew who had come to Jerusalem in order to attend the great Passover festival that was happening that week. And that would have been the custom for so many Jews who had been dispersed farther afield. Being a foreigner, my guess is that Simon, as he left his lodgings, as he made his way into the city that morning, he would have been completely oblivious as to what was about to happen. But as he passed by the area, he will have heard the people shouting and jeering and hurling insults at the criminals as they made their way to their execution. No doubt it grabbed his attention and led him to come up right among the people on the street so he could see what was happening for himself. And as he watched, perhaps he was standing there with his two boys, Alexander and Rufus. He would have looked on in horror at the middleman, Jesus, as he struggled to put one foot in front of the other. Jesus had been weakened and drained physically, emotionally from the ordeal of his overnight trial, six of them in all. He would have been just absolutely spent from the flogging that he had received, probably near to death. Verse 26. Jesus would have been a miserable sight. The skin across his body had been torn open by the leather whip that had been laced with metal and bones, leaving blood everywhere. His head would have been bruised and swollen from where he'd been beaten, verse 30. And there would have been blood on his face as well from where they had placed and pressed the crown of thorns into his brow. It would have been a terrible sight. Jesus would have been so disfigured that unless you'd known who he was, it may have been difficult to make him out. As he carried his own cross, he struggled under its weight until he stumbled to the ground right in front of Simon. Now, you need to know that in those days, soldiers on execution duty had two jobs. The first job was to get the criminals to the execution site in order to crucify them there. And the second job was to then make sure that the prisoners were dead, that the job was done. And they didn't take kindly to prisoners dying before their appointed time. They enjoyed seeing them suffer. And so seeing how weak Jesus had become, and to make sure that Jesus got all the way there to where he needed to be, the hill of Calvary, a soldier turned to Simon and forced him to step in and carry the cross instead of Jesus. You could say that for Simon, it was the wrong place at the wrong time. But now that he'd been singled out, Simon had no choice. He'd been press-ganged into service. To have refused would have had terrible consequences, not just for Simon, but also for his family members with him that day. And so Simon took the cross on his shoulders and carried it for Jesus until they arrived at Golgotha, the place of the skull, where Simon then became a witness of Jesus' crucifixion. Imagine with me what it would have been like for Simon that day. We have no idea had he met Jesus before. Surely he'd heard about him. Most everybody had. But I wonder what it was like as they walked together the Via della Rosa that day. Did they speak together? If so, I wonder what was said. We're not sure, but I wonder if maybe Simon turned to Jesus and with a heart full of compassion for this broken and dying man, I wonder if he said, "We're nearly there, Jesus. Keep going." And his heart would have broken just as mine does today, thinking of my Savior and my Lord. We don't know what was said on that journey. Maybe it was, "We're nearly there, Jesus. You can do it." We don't know how Simon felt about carrying the cross that day. All we know is that from our passage before us, there's no indication of any protest from Simon when the soldiers put the cross on his back. I can only guess that in those moments, seeing Jesus like that, compassion rose up in Simon's heart, enough to bring him willingly to carry the cross for Jesus. And at least for those moments, Simon became a burden bearer for our Lord. But then we see these compassionate ministers, as it were, who reach out and seek to minister to Jesus in his pain, offering Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, verse 34. It would seem that in those days, crucifixion was a normal part of life. There were so many that died that way under the Romans. But it would seem that in those days, a sort of guild or association of kind-hearted, charitable women in Jerusalem had formed this sort of compassionate sisterhood. And among other things, they offered relief in the form of this drugged drink to help lessen the intensity of the pain of the crucifixion to come. We're not sure if it was these women who stopped there and stepped in order to offer this drugged drink to Jesus, if they took pity on him. But in those moments before he was nailed to the cross, whether it was them or whether it was one of the Roman soldiers, they stepped in. They offered him this wine vinegar mixed with myrrh. Anybody remember myrrh from an earlier part in Jesus' story? Wine vinegar mixed with myrrh and gall. It would have been bitter. It would have been sour to taste and drink. And after tasting it, Jesus turned it down. I'm sure he was thankful for their kindness. I'm sure he was thankful for the pity. I'm sure that their compassion would have cheered his heart. But he was unwilling to let anything get in the way of feeling the pain of death. He didn't want anything to cloud his mind from being aware of what he was about to do. His focus was on his higher calling, his mission, to die for the sins of the world. The compassionate ministers. And then we find a courageous man who, after Jesus had been crucified, and as Jesus is in his last moments, gasping for breath, he steps forward and offers Jesus wine vinegar to drink, verse 48, to quench his thirst. You see, death by crucifixion was an awful ordeal. Not only is the person publicly humiliated by stripping them naked for all to see, they then either tied or nailed the person to a cross that's then raised up for the person to hang there until they die. The piercing pain of the nails for Jesus and the torn tendons and the damaged nerves would have been excruciating. In fact, it's that Latin word for the cross, crux, from which we get the word excruciating in the first place. The suffering was intense, even more so in hot climates like this one. Inflammation from the bruising and the wounds that Jesus had experienced, along with the continued bleeding, would have brought about a traumatic fever that was only aggravated by exposure to the heat and the sun. And as Jesus hung there, he would have had to strain and push himself up from his feet on the cross in order to gasp for breath. And the thirst would have been overwhelming. As tetanus set in, as his blood was being contaminated there by the nails in his hands and the rust and whatever else, it gave way to rigors and convulsions. It would have torn his wounds even further, causing even more pain, until he sank into unconsciousness and death. As one commentator put it, the person being crucified would literally die a thousand deaths. And although the length of one's suffering there on the cross would have depended on how strong they were going into it all, it's said that people rarely died on a cross before 36 hours, a day and a half. As Jesus neared the end, he was much weaker, having experienced everything that had gone before. And his body was going through all of those experiences I've just described and more. John's gospel tells us that Jesus became very thirsty. And taking compassion on him, this courageous man stepped forward and ministered to Jesus, offering him something to drink. Wine vinegar on the end of a sponge raised up to his mouth. How thankful Jesus must have been in those moments that someone was willing to go against the flow. Someone was willing to go against the mood of the crowd that was shouting for his blood. Someone was willing to go against their hostility. In the face of it all, this man stepped forward, unintimidated by the others around him, and he reached out to help the Son of God. What kindness, what tenderness, what compassion in those moments. What courage it would have taken to step forward like that, to take a stand in the face of such opposition. Then there were Jesus' faithful followers, these ladies that we hear about, these women in Matthew's gospel. And if we continue to read the accounts of the crucifixion in the gospels, we discover that there were a group of those who know Jesus, these women standing at a distance. Luke tells us that these included a number of holy women who had followed Jesus from Galilee and who had been his faithful followers. And Luke tells us that as they stood at a distance, they were no doubt horrified at what they saw, at the same time weeping as their master and their Lord was being killed. But because of their deep love for Jesus, they stood there to the end. Despite his utter humiliation, the shame that being associated with him would have brought upon them, despite all of those things, those friends of Jesus, those faithful women, remained to the bitter end. I can only imagine the strength and the encouragement that their presence there that day would have brought Jesus as he looked down from the cross and he saw their familiar faces there in the crowd, even at a distance. What a blessing they would have been to him. And then last, but definitely not least, we find a loyal friend and Jesus' loving family there at the foot of the cross. And what's fascinating about all the gospel accounts is they're telling the story of how it happened, the eyewitness accounts. John is the only disciple who is mentioned as having been at the cross that day. Sure, Luke mentions those who knew them. Matthew tells them that they were the women, the faithful followers of Christ. But where are the men? Where are the disciples? Where are the guys that Jesus had trained and poured his life into, with whom he'd spent so many hours over those last 3 years of ministry? Where were the ones that had seen God's kingdom coming through Jesus and his ministry over those past 3 years? It seems like they're nowhere to be found. Only John is named here as the disciple whom Jesus loved, standing at the foot of the cross with Jesus' mother and Jesus' aunt, with Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. Where were the men? Where are the men? Where were the other disciples that day? One had betrayed Jesus with a kiss. Others had fallen asleep in the garden and run in fear for their lives as the soldiers took Jesus away. One had denied Jesus 3 times and disowned him with a curse. One fell into a world of cynicism and doubt. Some walked away in order to return to their old familiar haunts and ways, and others remained hidden away, cowering in fear for their lives. And it seems that now only John was left. Only he is here now, standing with Jesus' family and closest friends. And as Jesus looks down from the cross in those final moments, no doubt trying to spot his friends, he only saw John, the disciple whom he loved, standing with and supporting his heartbroken mother. And he acknowledging John's loyalty and acknowledging his love for his mother, he entrusts his mother's care into his devoted disciples' care. Again, what strength, what comfort it must have been to Jesus to know that his mother would be cared for and looked after by his dear friend John, who remained loyal to the end. In the beginning, I mentioned about it being a case of the wrong place at the wrong time for Simon. But actually, looking at all of the others that we've highlighted this morning, you might say the same about them too. It's only when you look closer, though, that you find that each one of them was actually in the right place at the right time. As we said earlier, we don't know much about Simon who carried Jesus' cross. But later in Romans chapter 16, verse 13, we find Paul sending his greetings to Rufus, saying, "Greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother, who has been a mother to me too." Caring for Paul. We're not sure, but we think this Rufus might have been Simon's son. Meaning that even though Simon may have thought that he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, God turned everything around for good, because after carrying the cross for Jesus and seeing the way he died, Simon left that place changed. He arrived in Jerusalem that day just a simple pilgrim, but he left that evening as a follower of the man on the middle cross, Jesus of Nazareth, the Son of God. He left that day one of the first Christians. And what about the compassionate ministers, or the courageous man, or the faithful followers, or Jesus' loyal friend and his loving family? No doubt each of them stood there that day wondering, how in the world did it come to this? How did I end up here today? Wrong place, wrong time? No, because each one ended up playing their part. As they stood in the shadow of the cross that day, either standing firm in the face of opposition or bringing comfort and strength and showing compassion to Jesus in his hour of need. And maybe you're here this morning and you're thinking about your own life and you're asking yourself, how in the world did I end up here in whatever mess and whatever darkness and whatever struggle that you are finding yourself in today? Wrong place, wrong time? I would encourage you this morning, look at the cross and see how God placed each of these people in just the right place at the right time, either so that they could meet Jesus and be transformed in his presence, or indeed so that they could serve him and be a blessing to him in his darkest hour. And that being the case, as we approach Holy Week this week, as we approach Good Friday this Friday, I want to invite you, I want to invite each of us to pause, to look at our own lives, to ask, where are you when it comes to your relationship with Jesus Christ? Are you a believer? Are you a follower? Have you seen Jesus for who he is, the Son of God? Have you surrendered your life to him and invited him to be your true king? And standing firm for him, living as a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ, are you serving him today? Or are you seeking to minister to those in need around you, to bring hope in the midst of brokenness and pain? As we hold out the good news of Jesus Christ to our world around us. Or are you more like one of the others that we've talked about in our series, who either deserted Christ or doubted him, or who were openly hostile to him or wanted rid of him and that he would have nothing to do with their life? Or indeed, are you this morning more like one of those other disciples? The men who were once on fire with love for Christ, who were passionate about serving him, but now the love had grown cold. And maybe that's you today. And maybe you're feeling distant from God. And when it comes to serving him, you're nowhere to be found. In order to help us to answer those questions, in order to see ourselves for who we really are and to see Jesus for who he is, we're going to take a journey this Holy Week. And on Wednesday evening, we're going to ask the question, where were you when they crucified the Lord? Where were you, and were you there when they crucified my Lord? Then on Thursday evening, we'll return with Jesus and his friends to the upper room for the Last Supper. And then on Good Friday, we'll look once more at the cross. Because up to now, we've been looking at the characters around the cross. But Friday, we're going to look at the man on the middle cross. And we're going to think about the significance of what he did there for us. And I hope that you'll join us on this journey this week. I hope that you'll come out and you'll be part of this journey for yourself. Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, 8 p.m. Walking in the footsteps of Christ. Putting yourself in the shadow of the cross. So that when we reach Easter morning, we'll know why we're there.